This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me University of Wisconsin history professor Sean Francis Peters, who's the author of a fascinating new book, which I've been waiting to read here for several months. It's called The Catonsville Nine, A Story of Faith and Resistance in the Vietnam Era. Sean Francis Peters, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks so much, Matt. Great to be here.
You know, I ran into you at a party. It must have been year and a half or 2 years ago now, where you talked to me about this book you were doing on the Catonsville Nine, which I had heard about, not your book, I'd heard about the Catonsville Nine, mostly because Howard Zinn wrote something about it for the Progressive Magazine, and I didn't have a lot of background on the subject, so I made a mental note right there that when the book came out, I wanted to not only read the book, but get you here in the studio, so I'm delighted you're here. Let's start with a little biographical information about you for the listener who's hearing us in her car or in his kitchen or in the office. I was amazed and amused to read on the very first page of the book that you actually grew up in Catonsville and that this story has been with you forever.
Sure. So I was born in 1966, and the demonstration of the Nine was in 1968. So I wasn't quite old enough to really actually remember the event, but I grew up in the town, and I went to elementary school and attended a Catholic church, you know, literally right around the corner from where this happened. And so as a kid, I kind of had heard this story about these, you know, Catholic activists who had gone into the local draft office and seized these files and burned them and waited for the cops to show up. And you know, as a kid, it was really like, it's kind of a crazy story in a good way. And so as I was younger and in school, I wrote about it in high school, and I sort of have just kept the story with me for a really long time and finally got it out of my system. I figured I should, you know, write a book about it. I've written about religion and law quite a bit in some other books, but this is the book that has been sort of in the back of my head for a really long time.
So it must be cathartic in a way to get it done.
Cathartic in a way, yeah. Sometimes it's, I don't know that I was really ready intellectually. It's kind of a complex story to tell, and I'm not sure if I had done it 10 years ago, I'm not sure I would have been able to figure out how to do it.
Not everyone who grew up in Catonsville and was born in 1966 and heard about the Catonsville Nine, these protesters burning draft files, selective service files, went on to write papers about it in grammar school, though, and much right. less grammar school, high school, and then obsessed about it for decades after that. Why your peculiar fascination, do you think?
I've always liked sort of outsiders and people on the fringe, and I think I've become sort of an establishment guy as I've gotten older. But, you know, as a kid, I sort of identified with people questioning authority in really kind of a brazen way. And two of the nine, you know, Philip and Dan Berrigan, were priests. And for me, that was so unusual that I really kind of latched onto it. I like things that are sort of outside the norm, that it wasn't just the same old story about, you know, heroes and villains, that it was kind of a complex thing.
You say in your introduction that these guys weren't just heroes, that they're human beings, that they're heroes and sinners, as you, saints and sinners, I think, as you put it. Tell me a little bit about the Berrigans.
Sure. So Dan and Phil Berrigan were these iconic radical Catholic priests. And in the 60s, you know, the Catholic Church is sort of changing after Vatican II, and there's a sort of new breed of activist priests. And Dan and Phil were at the forefront of that. They were deeply involved in peace and social justice activism. And as often happened with people in the 60s who were interested in such issues, you know, their attention eventually turned to Vietnam, and they got to really at the forefront of that sort of clerical movement against the war as well. And so they're the two people of the nine that people know the most about. And after Catonsville, they had long careers as activists. And Dan Berrigan, bless his soul, is still alive and is still, you know, is still out there, you know, lending his name and his efforts to peace and social justice causes. So they had these long careers in this realm. And Catonsville, in many ways, I think, is the high water point for both of them. Or it was the thing that really kind of solidified their reputation as radicals, because they really risked a lot. When you're a Catholic priest and you take on the federal government, that's no small thing. So for a lot of people, it didn't put them on the map, but it certainly, you know, made them, I would say, sort of household names. They were on the cover of Newsweek later and things like that.
And 60 Minutes did a special on them, I remember, later on in their careers. But some of the Catonsville Nine didn't want to be in the shadow of the Berrigans, and later on some of them didn't want to be in the shadow of the church even.
Sure. And that's one of the great things about doing the book. I really wanted to make it not a book that was the Berrigans and the Seven Dwarves. I wanted to talk about those other seven people who were really cool and did amazing things. And it just, for instance, Mary Moylan is one of the nine who sort of gets forgotten, although she spent almost a decade underground. She had this incredible run from J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI in the
1970s. Let's talk about her a little more, because I found her fascinating too, and kind of sad ultimately at the end, because she was dealing with alcoholism and was alone. But she was a Irish Catholic. She was very fiery, and she was a nurse too, right?
Yep. Yeah, and she had spent time in Uganda and in Africa in the 1960s, and that was sort of the cauldron for her, the fulcrum politically.
And she joined the group that was organizing this. She'd been involved in the anti-war activity in the Baltimore area?
Sure, in D.C., yeah.
In D.C., but she was the only one of this group. Catonsville is a suburb of Baltimore,
right? Right, she was the only Baltimore native of the group.
But, you know, after she decided to go underground, she was the only one who wasn't caught by the FBI. She actually turned herself in. I'm actually fascinated by these, whether underground and other people who went underground and then turned themselves in. Why in the world, after 10 years underground, would you turn yourself in, or did she turn herself in?
She did turn herself in, and I think that she was just exhausted by it. I mean, I gained an appreciation from following her story. And one of the things I did in writing the book is I obtained files from the FBI, you know, thousands and thousands of pages. And we think of this underground existence as being, I don't know if we romanticize it, but it seems sort of, you know, cool. And it's not at all. It's really oppressive and just an emotional burden. And so for Mary, I think eventually, just she was cut off from her friends, she was cut off from her family, and she just and what was interesting is that the FBI hadn't forgotten about her, but they really weren't even looking for her.
Why was that though? I saw that in the book too, and it just seemed, wow, if she was one of these nine that the FBI seems so worried about all the time, why neglect her? Was that sexism, or did they think she just didn't have a political following?
I think that they thought they had bigger fish to fry, and they weren't concerned that she was dangerous. I talked to an FBI agent who was part of the investigation, and he told me, you know, it was over time, we just figured, you know, she had sort of vanished and she would turn up eventually, but we didn't get the sense that she was out doing anything, you know, that was really dangerous.
But even more than the others who went underground, and not all the nine went underground, she was the one who most affiliated with the Weather Underground and the more out there wing of the 60s rebellion.
She did, and it was a little bit difficult in writing the book to kind of figure out what her relationship precisely was with those groups. And I think that she was a kind of a fellow traveler, not deeply involved in sort of core Weather Underground activities, but certainly was in their orbit as well. And that's sort of why she remained on the FBI's radar for so long. But by 1979, you know, that she had sort of been had lost in the mists of history. And that's when she turned herself in.
I'm speaking with Sean Francis Peters. He's a historian at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of this really interesting book called The Catonsville Nine, A Story of Faith and Resistance in the Vietnam Era. The Catonsville Nine were nine Catholic anti-war activists, but not just that, who destroyed Selective Service files with homemade napalm, of all things. Mary Moylan, before we leave her, I mean, she also seemed to me the one, in your depiction, who was the most explicitly feminist, or became more feminist along the road.
Oh, absolutely. And her ideology really, even before she had she went underground, you could see her focus sort of changing from war and race to feminism. And she wrote a lot while she was underground. And those writings are, you know, very explicitly feminist in their orientation. And, you know, she even subsequently, in these writings while she was underground, she said, you know, if I had to do Catonsville all over again, I don't think I would have done it with men. I think I would just have done it with my sisters. And she, Mary, I think really over time came to, she was less comfortable with the patriarchy of the Catholic Church. And I think that she, over time, maybe saw the Berrigans as representing that kind of patriarchy as well. And so she, I don't think that she ever wrote anything, you know, directly about the Berrigans, but indirectly it's pretty clear that that's what she was pulling away from, and she became more sort of vehemently feminist as time passed.
Well, what was your assessment of that? Was there sexism prevalent in the way the Catonsville Nine organized themselves or came to decisions?
You can see elements of it, and especially, you know, Phil Berrigan, for instance, is a very dynamic and forceful person and had a really interesting and coherent worldview. But Phil, I don't think if you were a emerging feminist at the time, you would have thought of Phil as being a feminist. And so, for instance, in the way the clerks in the office that the Nine attacked were these women, and two of them were older women. And what Phil wrote and said about one of the head clerk, who was this woman named Mary Murphy, was really, he called her a portly Irish matron and said that she was, you know, the victim of schizophrenia and stuff, and really was uncharitable toward them. So you can see it. For as much, and this is one of the great paradoxes, right, of the movement was, you had people on the front lines talking about justice and equality, and yet within the movement you had people who were still sort of working out gender equality. And you can see that, and certainly when Mary pulled away from the rest of the Nine, that was there. You could see it.
There was another conflict when they were going in that building with this clerk, Murphy. Because, you know, these Catonsville Nine are dedicated to nonviolence, and the clerk, Mary Murphy, was defending the files. And so they had to, your expression is manhandled. The Berrigan, I guess it was Phil Berrigan, manhandled.
Right.
And that is, that's a violent act. I mean, we can talk about violence to property, which destruction of the Selective Service files was, but that certainly, to my mind, is not as bad and perhaps totally justifiable compared to violence against people. And this was one instance where there was violence.
Yeah, so she didn't, Mary Murphy, she wasn't beaten up, but she had some minor, cuts and bruises and stuff after this. And lots of people who were sympathetic to the Nine subsequently said, hey, wait a minute, this isn't maybe pure nonviolence at all. If what you needed to do was confront these women, frighten them, and manhandle them, that word gets used a lot. And I think that actually Phil Berrigan used it himself in describing what he did to Mary Murphy. And he said, she got in the way, she wouldn't give up. I sort of had to manhandle.
And they seemed to be sensitive to it right afterwards, because even when they were, right after they burned the files, before the police came or the FBI came, they were saying, God, we hope we didn't hurt you.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, though, that Phil Berrigan and Tom Lewis had been involved in an earlier draft protest in Baltimore, these guys called the Baltimore Four. And there was actually a similar confrontation with a woman named Mabel Pearson at the Custom House in downtown Baltimore. So it happened again in sort of the same way actually isn't – it shouldn't have surprised them at all that these women offered kind of like fierce resistance. Mary Murphy, she really believed in protecting those files, and she did what she thought she had to do. And so afterward, people like Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton, who were certainly ideologically affiliated with the Nine, when they heard about how the demonstration actually went down, they said it gave them pause. And certainly Dorothy Day supported the Nine. She was at the trial. She spoke at these rallies that were held in conjunction with it. But she clearly had some reservations about it and basically said, you know, this isn't sort of in the Catholic work, at least in the Catholic worker tradition of nonviolence.
I'm speaking with Sean Francis Peters. He's the author of The Catonsville Nine. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. This is one of the landmark protests against the Vietnam War, certainly as far as civil disobedience goes. But it wasn't just about the Vietnam War, which is something I learned in reading this fascinating book of yours. Explain what else it was about.
Well, I think it was broadly about imperialism, militarism, poverty, and inequality, and how those things are sort of bound together in our political economy. And just in the realm of foreign policy and militarism, certainly Vietnam was front and center. But three of the Nine, Thomas and Marjorie Melville and John Hogan, actually had been missionaries in Guatemala throughout the 1960s up to just a few months before the Nine staged their demonstration, and they were really concerned about Guatemala. And
they were working with rebels to some extent.
Yeah, it was a part of the story I really loved was what they were doing with these sort of proto-revolutionary activity. So they went to Catonsville explicitly because of Guatemala. And if you look at the statement of the Nine, it was this multi-page statement they handed out to the reporters, and it really goes into some depth about Guatemala and how Guatemala and Vietnam were products of this sort of misguided foreign policy as well.
That has gotten lost in history or in the memory of this event. Was it lost in the coverage of the event?
It was lost in the coverage.
So it was lost upon birth, practically.
Pretty much. And, you know, there's this sort of shorthand that people, you know, it's Catholic priests, Vietnam, the draft, and people move on. And so the complexity of it is not there. Although at the trial, certainly, you know, they were given wide latitude to testify, and they testified quite a bit about Guatemala. And that it sort of comes through, but we have this way of describing protest activities in the 60s, and it's sort of, well, it's either civil rights or it's Vietnam, one of the two. And this is one that was really both of those things. They worried a great deal about racial inequality and how the war was sucking up resources and attention and sort of exacerbating racial and economic injustice in the United States.
One of the most radical members also had been working in Latin America with the Agency for International Development, and AFIELD even, of the AFL-CIO. Talk about him.
Sure. George Mishy was in the Caribbean and in Central America as well. And George was another person who really, he had a sense of how these things sort of fit together. And so his experiences, again, and his attention wasn't focused so much on Vietnam, but it was focused on, you know, labor and economic equality as well.
Now, let's get into the action that they took, and then I want to talk about kind of some of the lessons that we can draw from the Catonsville Nine, if we may. Originally, though, I think Phil Berrigan wanted to blow up the Custom House. You talked about the central office of the Selective Service in Baltimore. That surprised me. Of course, I'm in Madison, Wisconsin, where we did have a building that was blown up, and one person was killed by accident. But it totally devastated not only that family, obviously, but the whole anti-war movement here in Wisconsin. Why were they thinking of doing that? Why were they encouraged to do something else?
They all, and it's kind of a familiar story, you know, they had tried traditional means of protest. They had written letters, they had marched, they had done all of the things sort of within the accepted boundaries of the protest environment, and they felt like they were getting nowhere. And finally, you know, Phil Berrigan and Tom Lewis said, we need to do something more. We need to attack the physical machinery of the draft. And if we got our hands on these files, maybe we could impede that. And at one point, they had thought about setting off an explosive device at the Customs House in downtown Baltimore. And I don't know how far they really got with that idea. There's no evidence that they, you know, took steps to actually execute that plan. But they talked about it, and they had met with an attorney in Virginia named Phil Hirschkopf, and he said, wait a minute. And cooler heads prevailed. I think that that might have just been a moment of sort of excessive, you know, radical rhetoric. But, you know, what they did do was, I mean, they did seize these files. They did, as you mentioned, they had cooked up some napalm themselves.
And is it that easy to cook up?
Yeah, it's gasoline and soap flakes. That's crazy. All you need to do. And so it was this symbolic act as well. I mean, I think that they took fire as a kind of Christian symbol of the Pentecost. And so it was radical, and it was the striking event in its own right, what they actually did. And then they waited around, and they had invited reporters to film and report on the whole thing, and then they waited for the police.
And Dan Bergen had that powerful statement that he issued right on the spot. Our apologies, good friends, for the fracture of good order, the burning of paper instead of children. Was that extemporaneous, or did he have that written down?
Well,
or?
It's interesting, you know, and that's the statement that people remember as being the statement of the nine. But, you know, Dan joined the group at the 11th hour. He's actually the ninth person in the nine. And Phil Berrigan said to him, well, Johnny come lately, you know, we're not going to let you. So there's a separate statement, and then Dan has this sort of separate meditation that you quoted, and that's the thing that people remember as the statement of the Catonsville Nine, and it's not at all. It's a wonderfully eloquent and powerful statement. The real statement of the Nine is this. It's almost like a public policy paper written by Phil in the tradition of the great UW-Madison historian William Appleman Williams. It reads very much like that.
Looking back on the Catonsville Nine, what did they accomplish?
Well, you know, that's a really tough question. And in the short term, I mean, I don't think that they actually believed that incinerating, you know, 370 draft files was going to bring the war to a close or even seriously impede the draft. I think that what they hoped was that they would inspire other similar protests. And they did, you know, in Milwaukee, for instance, the Milwaukee 14, you know,
I mean, there were hundreds of protests.
Yeah, it was actually bigger. Yeah, all over the place. And those did have the effect of sort of slowing down, messing up the draft. Lewis Hershey, who was the head of Selective Service, was really bothered by them. The draft itself, though, it was actually litigation that really stopped the draft. And so Dan Berrigan has said that Catonsville, it was sort of part of the mix. It was the part of this overall anti-war, you know, fervor that sort of helped shape public policy and public opinion over time.
You write that it did relatively little to stop the war.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that it didn't. So in an immediate sense, I don't think that it slowed down things very much at all. But I think it has certainly resonated with, here we are almost 45 years later, still talking about it. And lots of people took great inspiration from the Nine. And so it had that sort of lasting impact, in part because of the play that was based on it, still produced, and there was a film made by Gregory Peck. So over the long term, I think it has influenced people. In the short term, I don't think that it, you know, Peck made this joke about the film. He said, well, I think maybe the film shortened the war by 15 minutes. And that's, you know, I think that the same could be said about the event itself. It didn't actually have a great immediate impact, but it certainly over time had a great influence on lots of people.
What did stop the war? I mean, or more precisely, to what extent do you credit protests for helping to stop the war?
Wow. I mean, I think that there was a collective exhaustion with the war. That's eventually sort of what happened. We sort of lost the political will to execute it, and certainly the anti-war movement played a major role in doing that, in making it just sort of politically impossible to execute the war further. But it took so long. I mean, you have to remember, the Nine acted in the spring of 1968, and then in the fall of 1968, I mean, Nixon got elected. The nine hoped to use their trial in the fall of 68 to expose Spiro Agnew, right, who was Nixon's running mate. He was the governor of Maryland. They wanted to embarrass Agnew and sort of screw up the Republican ticket. And they couldn't even do that in 1968. So this was even pre-Nixon, and it took until, you know, 1975 for everything to finally wind down.
I'm speaking with historian Sean Francis Peters, is the author of The Catonsville Nine. And I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. One of the Catonsville Nine was kind of ruefully looking back, or existentially looking back, Tom Melville, I'm thinking of, who said, "We are an asterisk in history." It's kind of a funny line. I mean, we're all asterisks in history, unless we're a president or a king or a pharaoh or William Shakespeare. Was he being questioning whether it was worth it for him?
I think in Tom's case, yeah. I mean, I think Tom and Marjorie both have looked back on Catonsville and have said, you know, they have actually done other things to help the people of Central America that were more effective and that were more impactful. And so I really respect that about Tom, that he doesn't have sort of rose-colored glasses looking back. I think he's proud of what he did and he thinks it's meaningful, but I don't think that Tom doesn't run around the country saying, "Yeah, I changed the world," because he doesn't.
You know, their story, I'm sorry to interrupt, their story is so poignant to me because they were so dedicated to the liberation of the people of Guatemala, the peasants who were so oppressed, and they spent the better, many years of their lives. And then she was a nun, and was he a priest? Anyway, they decided to get married, so right. They had to leave that calling, and they came back here they were kicked out. They came back here to further the cause of liberation in Guatemala, and then they kind of got sucked in, maybe that's too strong a term, to this action, but the action in a way was sprung on them. They had to decide instantly, and I remember Marjorie saying, "Tom, you decided at the drop of a hat without even talking to me that you were going to do it."
Right, yeah. Marjorie especially, I thought, you know, wait, what are we doing? Everyone is going to view this action as being, you know, directed at the war in Vietnam, and our energy should be devoted exclusively to the people of Guatemala. Eventually, she was convinced that people would see the sort of totality of the sort of foreign policy worldview, and that people would get that it was also about Guatemala. I think in retrospect now, they realize, you know, pretty quickly that that's actually not what happened. People talked about it as being about Vietnam, and so I think that they have worked through that over time. I think that they still appreciate what they did, but they don't overstate its importance.
We just have 30 seconds left, and I want to ask one big question. I hope you're going to have one short answer to it. A lesson for people in the Occupy movement or activists who get frustrated with legal protest, even with subdued civil disobedience, what do you suggest?
I would say be prepared for the unexpected consequence. You can have a plan, and the nine certainly plan things out meticulously, but things evolve and mutate and change over time, sometimes in a good way too. And that's one thing that the story of the nine shows, is that evolution and change and unexpected consequence.
Well, that's all we have time for. Sean Francis Peters, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you so much, Matt.
The book again is The Catonsville Nine, A Story of Faith and Resistance in the Vietnam Era. You've been listening to Progressive Radio.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.